the Empire Podcast this week, we make it so with the great Patrick Stewart, here to talk about his stunning turn in Logan, and we talk about that jaw-dropping Oscar moment, you know, when Moana lost out on Best Song. All this and the usual movie news, reviews and nonsense on the only movie podcast that double-checks every single envelope before we open it. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen O'Hara and welcome to the Empire Podcast, sponsored this week by the good folk at Three, the network that allows you to use your phone in 42 destinations abroad at no extra cost. Believe me, as a highly glamorous international jet-setter myself, this is a lifesaver and a money-saver when you're travelling. I've used it in the United States, Australia, Spain and Sri Lanka, to name but a few. Even more excitingly, Three are the headline sponsor for this year's Empire Awards, which I think we can all agree is going to be the most exciting and surprising award show of 2017, right? Yeah, definitely. So this week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning that even John Wick treads cautiously around them. And since Chris isn't here this week, he's actually moving house at the moment, good luck with that, he's not here to make supernatural jokes, so I've decided to make some of my own. So first up, we have our very own Castiel-alike, a man who looks surprisingly uncreepy in a trench coat, but can't get to grips with answer phones. It's Nick DeSemelin.
Hey, Helen. Yes, I think that's a good joke. I can't tell. I haven't seen Supernatural, and I only know from it from this podcast, so that they all have their shirts off all the time. That's right.
I mean, they really, like, never literally do. But Castiel is an angel, so, you know.
I looked him up last night, and I looked at there's a Wikipedia page dedicated to Castiel, and it's like 90,000 words long, and it's so complicated. He has like 10 different names. Apparently he used to be human, then he was an angel, and now he's a seraph. Is that true?
I guess, yeah.
And his code name is Agent Beyonce.
Yes.
Well, this makes no sense.
Well, so when the Winchester brothers pretend to be FBI agents, which they do all the time because they're investigating crimes.
Shirtless ones.
Shirtless ones, of course. They will introduce themselves by naming obscure music stars. So Plant, Robert Plant or something. They'll claim like heavy metal stars as their real names. But Castiel got the idea, but not quite the execution, so called himself Agent Beyonce.
Amazing.
Yeah.
This is good. The Supernatural Podcast. No, that's good. That's a good fact.
So then we have our Crowley substitute who makes the King of Hell look warm and fuzzy, or at least Scottish. It's James Dyer.
I resent that.
Why?
To be fair, Crowley's actually quite cool. It's Mark Shepard, isn't it? From Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
But now remind me, he's a demon?
He's a demon.
I like that he's a demon. I saw myself as more of a long lost Winchester, but I could take a demon.
don't want to be the long lost Winchester. The long lost Winchester is still stuck in hell.
Right.
Like seven seasons later.
Okay, fine. I'll take a demon.
Wait, no, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, guys. Guys, I'm sorry. No, there's been a mistake.
What's happening?
James, you're not the Potter this week. John is the second Potter of this week. John is potting. This is not a joke. Come up here, John. This is not a joke. I'm sorry, I read the wrong intro.
This is unprecedented.
Wow. John, it is my honour to hand the microphone over to you.
This is
instead.
Really...
Wow.
Well, this is what happens when Warren Beatty organises the podcast while Chris away.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Leaving the stage.
Even in my wildest dreams, this could not be true.
Enough with dreaming, John. Yes, our final Potter is the Empire equivalent of Supernatural's Charlie. He's young, he's talented, and he's probably hiding a tattoo of Princess Leia riding a 20-sided die somewhere around his person. It's John Nugent.
Hello.
That's just great comedy. Can we stop and just... That's just great comedy.
Let's just congratulate ourselves
well done
on
us.
A fantastic comedy bit that everyone will appreciate.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Great comedy. Can I just say, because I also looked up Charlie from Supernatural, and I thought, okay, this is cool. This is like going to be one of these hot shirtless guys. No, it's a lady, Charlie Bradbury, also known as the Queen of Moons.
Yeah, played by Felicia Day,
the Woman of Letters.
Well, I'll be honest here.
Is she not Agent Beyonce?
I was going to introduce. Basically, I was trying to think of characters that weren't the Winchesters. Because I thought that was a bit too obvious.
Yes.
You wanted to be both of them.
Obviously. But there are, and it is actually, as we record this, it's Jensen Ackles' birthday, so happy birthday to him.
Oh.
But I was kind of like torn on the other male characters. They're not that lasting. A lot of people die very fast in Supernatural. I was thinking of Kevin Tran, who was a teen genius who became gifted with the ability to read like angelic script, but I couldn't quite make that one work, so I thought Charlie was better.
This show sounds batshit.
It really does.
I'm going to watch an episode before next week.
Yeah, good.
Okay, just to warn you, they're not actually shirtless, like, ever.
That's okay, that's not why I want to watch it.
Well, I'm just making sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Promise.
Well, things are as at least as chaotic as when Chris is here already. So that's we're going well today. Right, so things are already as chaotic as if Chris were here or as if PwC were in charge of the pod script. Hey. So that Oscars, what did you guys make of it? You were up all night, John, right?
I was live tweeting for Empire, and I was in the office with Emma Thrower, our Oscar prognosticator, who's, it's a shame she can't be here.
Who did very well in her prognostication.
She did. I mean, I think it was her least successful year of predicting because there were a few surprises.
There were, yeah. Kevin O'Connell, I know she didn't predict.
Yes. And, you know, Moonlight, she didn't predict.
Yeah.
Nor did Warren Beatty. Let's be honest. That was, yeah. I mean, if you're staying up to watch the Oscars and it's 5 a.m. when they hit Best Picture, and you know my bloodstream was 95% caffeine at that point.
Yeah.
So my heart is already going twice the speed of a healthy man. To suddenly see this, the most extraordinary sort of screw up ever in the Oscars. I mean, I nearly had a panic attack. It was incredible. It was so dramatic to watch.
There were so many people on the stage. I thought the stage was going to collapse at one point.
Just that was a danger. Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
that would have been a heck of a way to end the night. But it was quite a kind of, I mean, I only watched the highlights, but it seemed like quite a sort of staid and not massively thrilling.
It was by the numbers until that moment.
It just went insane.
Yeah.
And it was the guy, it was one of the accountants, wasn't it? The guy who was tweeting backstage.
He was tweeting backstage, gave the wrong envelope to Beatty, who then knew something was wrong, but still sort of didn't know quite what to do about it, which is fair enough. I don't think any of us would quite know what to do in those circumstances either. He showed it to Dunaway, who just saw the headline and read out La La Land. The big problem, and the reason that neither accountant will ever do the Oscars again, apparently, is that there was a procedure in place, and the procedure was meant to be that they went on stage immediately. Mm-hmm. And in fact, what happens, apparently, is that either they didn't realise because they weren't paying attention because they were too busy tweeting, or they just froze, and neither of them did anything for about a minute and a half, at which point they told the stage managers and left it to them to sort things out.
And by which point the La La Lands had already given their speeches.
They were on stage. I think three of them gave a speech. Yeah. I mean,
they needed a better system for getting people off. I think trapdoors would have been effective. or some kind of giant hook.
You
could just grab people.
A giant hook is a classic, you know, so...
But it was carnage.
Somebody on Twitter yesterday said that typography is important here, because if you'll notice on the winners' cards, the category was written in really small letters at the bottom of the card, and there might have been less confusion if it had said in big letters "Best Actress."
Yeah.
Warren Beatty could have seen quite clearly that this was the wrong card.
Well, apparently, actually, the stage managers and that team had actually complained about the new design of the envelopes and the cards. The cards were redesigned to make them at least as clear as they were, because apparently initially they weren't legible at all.
Oh, right.
But the envelopes were not, and they were gold on red, and apparently they were quite difficult to tell.
Yeah.
Now, this is not to let PwC off the hook, but it is to back up your point that, yes, design matters.
It really does. So. It really does. But we shouldn't let this monumental catastrophe overshadow the winners of the Oscars, because, I mean, Moonlight was a shock just that it won, and it's quite a historic win. I mean, it's the smallest budget film ever to win Best Picture.
$1.5 million.
Yeah, there we go. La La Land, by comparison, $20 million, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the first film it's the second film centered around a black cast to win Best Picture. It's the first film about LGBT.
What was the first?
12 Years a Slave.
12 Years a Slave.
Yeah.
So only quite recently.
Yeah.
And also, it's a fantastic film. I think this really has got lost in the conversation a little bit. It's an incredibly worthy winner. A lot of people are saying it's one of the best Picture winners in years. Literally years. So... good night for them.
I was thrilled. I have to say, I mean, my, you know, antipathy towards La La Land is well documented on this podcast, as you know. But I have to say, I mean, this did make me come as close to feeling sympathy and warm feelings to La La Land as anything has. I mean, it is a horrendous thing to happen to them. It's also a horrendous thing to happen to Moonlight, because they did end up having to share their moment with another film. And that is really kind of rubbish. So while it is right to acknowledge, you know, the grace of particularly Jordan Horowitz dealing well with it, it is also right to acknowledge that the Moonlight people have been extraordinarily gracious about it, because it was their moment that was actually ruined.
It was really nice to see that both teams seem to have sort of a lot of mutual respect for one another.
True.
And they were both very sort of graceful. And
there's a great for the cover of the new Variety, and the story is online, is Damien Chazelle and Barry Jenkins the morning after the Oscars. I don't think either of them have slept. They're still in their kind of tuxes, and it's just them kind of having a chat about it all.
Yeah.
And they both take it very well.
They do, yeah.
I mean, they both had good nights. I mean, Moonlight also won Best Supporting Actor for Mahershala Ali, which was very well deserved.
Very much.
Barry Jenkins won Best Adapted Screenplay. La La Land got Best Director, as you say, and also Best Original Score and Song.
Suicide Squad won an Oscar.
Suicide Squad won an Oscar.
Just one. Yes,
the Oscar-winning Suicide Squad.
Just one.
I mean, the other thing is, I mean, okay, again, we don't love...
Joker's tattoos.
Yeah.
Again, we don't
tattoos.
Love...
Yeah,
but if you look at the makeup jobs in Star Trek, like even Best Makeup, which has in the past, we know, gone to Norbit, so it's not like, you know, overall film quality is a condition for Best Makeup. But even on the makeup front, I felt like Star Trek was better.
To be fair, I was on set of Suicide Squad for a few days, and the Killer Croc makeup was incredible
cool?
up
All
close.
Right.
And he did spend a lot of time. I mean, there was every day for months and months and months. But it was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think which other characters were particularly like makeup heavy. Obviously, the Joker's hair. It's like the colour of Orville, the duck. Yeah, I think it was basically Killer Croc that won it, honestly.
Yeah, fair enough, I guess.
It has the same amount of Oscars as Citizen Kane.
And more than Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems right to me, right?
Yeah.
That seems totally
I think
fair.
Those films are very much comparable.
What do we think of Jimmy Kimmel? I thought a lot of his stuff was funny. The Matt Damon continuing feud continues to amuse me mightily. The bringing tourists in, I thought that fell flat.
It was okay. It went on too long, I think, and it felt a bit... odd after a while. It felt like just, you know, a zoo of celebrities that they were taking selfies with.
That wasn't in the highlights program that I watched, which may make sense.
May explain a lot. I also think if you're going to host the Oscars, there are three things you shouldn't do. You shouldn't make jokes about, we haven't seen your film because it's too small. Unless it's like Avatar and they all have, and that's the joke. You shouldn't make jokes about pronouncing people's names wrong. Especially if their name is not John Smith. and he kind of did both of those, which was kind of a little disappointing.
Yeah, there was a few sort of thoughtless jokes along the way, but
generally, I thought
he was okay. There was a bit at the end where, when during the whole Moonlight La La Land debacle, he was just like, "Can't we just give everyone the Oscars?" Which was not the right tone to strike. I don't think that's how the Oscars work. Is you just sort of, if you say the wrong word, then you get an honorary Oscar.
Like, he was standing there in front of how many millions of people, not billions probably, but I mean, I thought he you know, lightened the mood. Warren Beatty was trying to make an apology. It was just all going off the rails at that point. I thought he was all right. I thought he leaned a bit too heavily on his kind of chat show.
Yeah.
It did seem like an extended Jimmy Kimmel Live, didn't it?
And
Yeah.
I did enjoy the Matt Damon stuff. I kind of went down. We've got a great article on the website at the moment, which is just going down the rabbit hole of all the Matt Damon, Jimmy Kimmel feud YouTube videos. Was that
you? I suggested that, yeah.
It's really fun. I watched it on my way in to work this morning. It's very funny.
Yeah, I absolutely love that stuff. I think I got into it all after the Sarah Silverman I'm Fucking Matt Damon video, and it went from there. But then I went back and watched some of the history.
I'm Fucking Ben Affleck video is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And it's Harrison Ford just there, like,
just for no reason.
All these people singing, and Harrison Ford's just right there on the edge of the frame, and you're like, why?
Yeah.
I really want to know the story.
Brad
behind.
Pitt delivering pizza. I mean,
it's really good. Yeah,
so good.
It's really good.
Anyway, we should actually take a question at some point.
Oh, yes.
It's been 15 minutes. So this week's question comes from Twitter. It's from Greg Slow. Apologies if I'm pronouncing that wrong. Surreal news that Marvel is coming to my small hometown. What movie stars have visited your hometown? So this is the news that Avengers Infinity War Parts 1 and 2 will be shooting in Scotland, in the city of, remind me?
Cumbernauld
in Scotland, where there is a film studio, and there was stories last year they were trying to expand it, because Scotland, the one thing the Scottish film industry majorly lacks at the moment is a big studio space. They have less than Wales and Northern Ireland, which seems unjust. So they're trying to build that up at the moment.
Okay.
Because the Scottish film industry otherwise is doing quite well, but they're stuck filming outdoors.
I would have thought they have loads of space in Scotland. I mean, it's massive. There's nothing there. It's just loads of mountains.
Like, but like with a roof, John.
You know? Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
So that's what they need.
Right.
Anyway, yeah. But Cumbernauld, Avengers, that's got to be a good step in the right direction for the Scottish film industry. So what movie stars have visited your hometowns? Have you had any?
My mind was blown last night because I started doing a bit of research into this. My favourite film of all time is Raiders of the Lost Ark. And right. I grew up in Chorley Wood in Hertfordshire. This tiny little village. There is nothing particularly remarkable about it apart from Dave Seaman, the ex-football goalkeeper, lives there, or used to live there. So that's pretty exciting. But I found out last night that the scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark where Indy helps the two army intelligence guys, remember they're drawing stuff on the blackboard and they get the Bible out?
Oh, yeah.
That scene was filmed in the Rickmansworth Masonic School.
No!
No way!
Right near where I live, like no 5 minutes from where I live. That's incredible. So I'm going to go there at some point and recreate that scene.
Is that on the end of the Metropolitan line?
Yeah, it's not right at the end, but...
like Zone 7 or something?
Zone 7, exactly.
All right.
So if you want to come on down and join me. I need two guys. Well, I need one guy with a moustache and another guy without a moustache to recreate that scene.
Okay, all right, I'll get right on it.
It's a good scene, and those two characters were kind of inspired by C-3PO and R2-D2, I think, in a weird way. Yeah, I remember reading something about it in the J.W. Rinsler book. Anyway,
wow.
I've got about that enough. Also, Me Before You, less excitingly, filmed in Cheney's, which is right near where I live as well.
Well, I mean, that's something, I suppose.
Yeah,
well, it's fine.
Yeah.
So my actual hometown of Port Stewart in Northern Ireland, we do have a really good golf course. So I know like Tiger Woods has played there, but I can't guarantee any film stars. I haven't been able to dig those up.
Has Tiger Woods ever been in a film?
Oh, I can't
I feel
think
like he
of
must
any.
Have done a cameo.
He probably should have, shouldn't
Howard's
he?
Film,
yeah.
So.
But no, I can't think of any. I mean, in the area, of course, basically, if you drive along the coast from Port Stewart, you basically pass through Westeros. Like, the whole coastline is basically Westeros.
Of course.
And you can literally do a tour, and there are now plaques up everywhere explaining, oh, this is in the Iron Islands, and this bit is where Renly Baratheon camped the night of the thing with the cave and the lady and the ooh
yeah. the thing with the cave and the lady got it.
people are going to know that, people are going to get it. But a better location for filming is near where I live now. So I live near Greenwich, and I go running in the morning over towards Greenwich Old Royal Naval College, and everything shoots in the Old Royal Naval College. So on my morning runs, I have personally with my own eyes seen Johnny Depp in full pirate's costume during the shooting of On Stranger Tides. I have seen Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly, yes, I was about to say McGinley, in their Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson costumes filming their untitled comedy Holmes project.
Holmes and Watson, I think it's called.
Holmes and Watson. It is. It has a title. Excellent. I have seen the big elephant from Les Mis, overturned cars from Red 2, and assorted bits and pieces from Thor 2.
Wow. You've been near the set of Red 2.
I've been near the set of Red 2. Yeah, you can touch me. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've been on the set of Red 2.
Whoa.
But, you know, yours is more impressive. Probably
I've seen Red 2, if that's impressive to anyone.
Is it?
I don't know. Greenwich seems like the sort of place that Americans think everyone is England.
Yes.
You know, like that seems to be like some sort of...
Although it did also play Russia in Man from U.N.C.L.E. It played
Russia.
Yeah.
Greenwich.
Yeah. It plays everything. It's recently been Buckingham Palace and The Crown. I saw them putting up a second set of columns to mimic the opening of Buckingham Palace.
You mentioned Ford the Dark World, right?
I did.
I did. And The Darkest Hour?
I didn't see it, but I know it was there.
Yeah.
And The Dark Knight was there. No, Dark Knight Returns was there.
What was
really?
Which bit was The Dark Knight Returns?
Florence. Was Greenwich.
No way.
The Dark Knight Rises.
Rises,
the,
sorry,
the bit
Rises.
Where in the Alfred sees Bruce Wayne and just sort of...
Yeah, raises a glass.
That's like the Costa Coffee.
Hey.
It's just the gift shop.
Greenwich has a Peyton and Byrne. Thank you very much.
Tiger Woods is in one film. Done a bit of research. Gentlemen Only, Ladies Forbidden, : Puddy McFadden, License to Golf.
What? What are those words?
That's his one credit.
I mean,
he plays LT Gray.
With a start like that, how has he not made more films?
This is like this is like Google whacking or something. We've got to find actors who've only appeared in one film. That's really strange.
Wow.
As a Spanish version of themselves.
Okay, but if anybody wants to stalk the Avengers, obviously then head to Cumbernauld. Don't really. Yes. We do not condone stalking.
Can I just add to this? The most exciting thing that I think has ever happened to me, when I was at school, I went to a school called Caldecott, which is near Farnham Royal in Buckinghamshire. And we used to do cross country through Burnham Beeches, which is this lovely forest. And when I was at school there, they were shooting Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. It was the most exciting thing. Wow. We knew they were filming this big Hollywood movie next to our little school. And one day I was doing cross country and I found an arrow.
Whoa.
Okay. I didn't see Kevin Costner, but I found an arrow. And I don't know what I did with that arrow, but I haven't got it anymore.
That's amazing.
But
great story, Hansel.
No, mate. My flatmate, his dad is a line producer, and he was a line producer on Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and he has one of the bows from Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. So maybe we can match up the bow and arrow and recreate.
What would happen?
We could recreate the bit where he goes through the arrow.
You just need a tiny little camera to put on the end of the arrow.
Yeah, exactly.
So he'd be blowing in my ear at that point. Would that be your dad? Your friend's dad?
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Okay. I've got a couple. Well, for my hometown is Hereford, which is tiny and insignificant and nothing ever happens there. So
I'm telling Hereford you said that.
I'm sorry, Hereford, but it's true. I think Hereford knows it's true. The only film connection that any Herefordian has is Frank Oz was born there.
Hey!
And that's really good.
He left there immediately after being born. he moved to Hollywood. But I think the most famous one I could find was W.E., the Madonna's hilariously bad film about Wallace Simpson. That was filmed in Eastner Castle, which is near where I grew up. But then I turned to like Camberwell, which is where I live now, and that's I guess the most famous thing is with Nell and I from Camberwell.
Pretty famous though.
Camberwell Carrot.
Camberwell Carrot. Yep.
I don't know if it was actually filmed there, but let's assume it was.
Have you ever recreated a shot from a movie when you're in a location where the exact shot was taken?
No, but maybe we
I don't
should
think
do
I
more
have.
It's a fun thing to do. I went to San Francisco quite a long time ago with a friend, and we recreated a shot from The Rock where Nick Cage has got the two flares, and we didn't use flares. Well, I don't know what we used, sticks,
water bottles, or something,
with Alcatraz behind us.
That's awesome.
That's pretty good.
It sounds cooler than it looks. It's really uncool. But that's a fun thing to do.
I when I was in New York, I went to the building where Men in Black, you know, the massive building where he goes in,
he goes down the alleyway.
And I made my sister take a photo of me and, you know, pretend I was Will Smith.
Did you pretend you had a neuralizer?
I didn't have a neuralizer on me at the time. Okay. But
there's a lot of that in New York, especially that you end up going around going, this is the bridge they walked across in Keeping the Faith.
Yeah, yeah.
A thought that I actually had.
That's amazing.
In Central
That's
Park.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It was also the bridge from like a lot of other things.
A lot of better things.
Yeah. I think it's in Harry Met Sally as well.
That's
obviously.
Good.
Keeping the Faith. God.
I mean, I just remember it from that moment.
So many years.
I went to the... anyone who's a fan of The Frighteners, Peter Jackson's The Frighteners, a film I absolutely love. But I seem to be the minority on it. But the end of the film is this big action scene with Michael J. Fox and a serial killer running around this what used to be a hospital. And this big spooky building, and I went there in New Zealand, and it was the coolest thing. And
awesome.
I recreated a shot, but no one cares. No one cares.
We care. We care.
Thanks, Alan.
Promise. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. If you want your question read out on the Empire Podcast and treated with that much expertise and knowledge, you can tweet to us. We are at Empire Magazine, and the hashtag is Empire Podcast, or we might not see it. You can Facebook us, where we are also Empire Magazine, or you can email us at podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, enough of our blather. It's time to add some class to these proceedings with a knight of the realm whose voice is, and this is coming from scientists, not just me, the most soothing sound in the history of the galaxy. He is Jean-Luc Picard. He is Professor Charles Xavier. He is dressed as a lobster on that one picture on Twitter. And of course, this week he stars in Logan, where he reprises his role as Charles Xavier for one last hurrah. Chris and I went along recently to speak to, ladies and gentlemen, Sir Patrick Stewart.
Oh.
We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Patrick Stewart. How are you, sir?
I'm just fine. Thank you very much. Happy to keep hearing how much you and your colleagues have enjoyed the movie.
Definitely. We really, really did. And a huge part of that is Charles Xavier as we've never seen him before, I think.
True. Nor had I ever conceived of him before or thought that the man that he becomes would ever make it into a superhero movie. But there he is, and it's been for me a great privilege to have a chance to walk in Charles's shoes again, although they're... I don't think I have any shoes in this movie. I think I wore nasty, dirty old slippers all the time. That's true, actually. I had slippers.
Yeah. Did you choose the slippers, or were the slippers given to you?
No, the slippers were handpicked for their nastiness. Oh.
Don't ask where they came from. Nope. You may not want to know.
Nope. Well, they came from a wardrobe somewhere on the 20th Century Fox lot.
Oh, then I guess you really don't want to know where they came from. Was it difficult in a way getting used to some aspects of Charles this time around? The swearing, for example.
No, not difficult at all. I was only excited by what I saw. Well, what I heard when little tidbits of news filtered down the top secret 20th Century Fox line of communication. And then finally a script arrived in my hands. And I'd already had a meeting with James, and I had been tipped off that this was Charles Xavier, very different from the gentle, intellectual, empathic individual that we'd seen over the years. And I was just excited. Mm. You know, what actor wouldn't be to have a chance to appear once more as a very familiar character who is completely transformed into almost someone unrecognizable, yeah. Both in appearance as well as in manner, style, mood, sentiment, everything.
Mm. Yes, because he has hair this time.
He has hair. I thought that was the boldest move that was taken. When it was suggested to me, I said, oh, come on. I mean, hair? He's completely hairless. But I think it was James who offered the idea. Well, you see, the thing is that his you know, blood circulation and other dynamics within his brain have re-energized the follicles and he has hair. There was not a hairpiece. It was not a wig. Those individual hairs were laid on one by one every morning.
Wow.
It took a while.
Yeah.
Again, were they found lying around the fox lot?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, no, they were actually foxes. Yes. They caught the foxes and shaved them.
I've heard that happens to fox quite a lot, actually. It's really disgraceful. But it's a really fascinating turn, a sort of fascinating iteration of Charles. This is a character that effectively you said goodbye to 10 years ago with The Last Stand when you were vaporized.
By Jean Grey.
By Jean Grey.
And
since then, you've been back... precisely. Since then, you've been back four times.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is fantasy, science fiction, comic book, whatever you wish. Mm-hmm. You can never say never again. Uh-huh. And, the Days of Future Past, the last I remember seeing of Charles... monstrous semi-mechanical creatures were invading the room where he and Logan and Magneto and who else was in there?
Oh, there was Kitty Pryde.
Was Rogue in there? Right. Oh, Kitty Pryde was in there, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And it looked as though the end was nigh for us.
But then we had the Happy Mansion ending, so everything seemed peachy again.
Oh, that's right. We did have the Happy Mansion ending. This time, I think there's no doubt that it's for good.
Yeah.
How does that make you feel now that... Because obviously a lot's been made of the fact that this is Hugh's farewell to Logan.
Oh, yeah. Well, Hugh has been public about that for a long time.
But this is also, we're guessing, your farewell to Charles.
I never thought of it that way at any point. In fact, it didn't really come home to me until last Friday night, way after midnight, at the screening in Berlin at the film festival. I'd seen it once before at a special private screening. But in Berlin, the ending was so emotional and intense, probably due partly to the fact that I was sitting next to Hugh, and about 5-6 minutes before the end of the movie, I felt his hand reach over and take mine and grip it. And then I saw that he was wiping away it, and I thought, oh, Lord, not me too. So there were these tough superheroes sitting in a cinema wiping away tears. And we had to wait for all the credits to roll before we were called up on the stage and introduced to the audience. So we were sitting there for quite a long time, you know, sniffling back and trying not to, you know, make too much of a show of the tissues that my wife had handed to us. And I thought, you know, they cannot, doesn't matter what scripts they come up with, it doesn't matter what ideas there are or renewals that could occur to them, this is the perfect farewell in such a beautiful context as the ending of this movie. So emotional and truthful and optimistic, that's the thing.
Yes.
And boy, do we need some optimism at the moment.
Yes.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, we were saying that this movie seems to be very politically pointed at the moment, even though it was made before everything started going to shit.
I mean, the primary objective of the principal characters in this movie, including the young people they subsequently meet, is to make it to a border, cross it into safety. Well, as we speak, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands actually trying to cross borders to make themselves safe. Families, single men and women, single children, children alone. The refugee situation worldwide is calamitous presently. And it is just an irony that the movie makers could not have been aware of, that given who is now sitting in the Oval Office, that the dangerous place is the United States. Mm-hmm. The border is the US-Canadian border, and Canada is the place of refuge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And absolutely, there's a wall along the Mexican border in this film as well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And economic strife is rife throughout the film.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And
yes,
the bad guy is called Donald. So it's...
It's amazing.
But just before we all jump out the window, I mean, you're right, there is real hope in this movie, because it's a story about a family, and it's a story about generations, and it's a story about, you know, the love between these three generations, really, mm-hmm, of this makeshift family, and then Laura as the sort of hope for the future, I suppose.
Yes, and her other friends.
And her friends.
All of them. But it's not a family story. That family is created during the course of the movie. Always Charles, throughout the history of X-Men, has felt a special responsibility for Logan. He knew Logan's past. He knew where he came from and what he had suffered. He was prepared to be patient when Logan was obnoxious or rude or even violent and obstreperous. And now, of course, you know, the obstreperous, violent, rude one is Charles. He's out of control, and so are his powers out of control, at putting everyone in peril, not just those close to him, but at some distance as well, as we see when they're in the casino. And Logan is now the father figure. He's the responsibility there, and he has to drive a nasty, shitty limo in order to make money to pay for Charles's medication, to keep him alive and to keep everyone safe. And then they are joined, welcomed by Charles, but resented by Logan, this child. And that is the centerpiece of the story, how that trio of lives become increasingly connected, where suspicion and rage exist. They begin very slowly to become a family. And I don't think ever before could perhaps the most important scene in the movie be a family dinner party.
Yeah.
Where a real family, and Xavier and Logan and X-23, as she is originally known, are sitting around a dinner table. And that changes everything. And we see the transformation gradually of Laura until that tear rolls down her cheek. You see, I begin to water up at the very thought of it. And they become, it's perfectly clear then, they have become a family.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's a beautiful, beautiful scene. That's the kind of moment that you don't get in most superhero movies. It's just people eating and, you
that's
know.
That's right, laughing, talking.
Laughing, yeah.
I mean, you are obviously no stranger to playing a character over a lengthy period of time. It's 17 years now since the first X-Men movie came out. And just in terms of the journey of Charles, there's a moment in this movie which really I thought was very, very touching, very realistic and very profound in a way. And it seems strange, but it's a moment where Logan takes Charles to the toilet. And that is something that you just would not have expected those characters to do back in 2000. But it is something that is very, very real as well to anyone who's been in a situation faintly analogous to that.
Indeed it is. It's a delightful scene. I doubted if it would stay in the movie. And so I was thrilled and thanked James for keeping it. But he loves the scene too, you know. And I also thanked him for not showing too much of the scene.
So he didn't see everything, did he?
We made sure of that.
What are your memories thinking back now on the first X-Men movie, which was back, you started shooting it in 1999.
I remember very vividly the first read-through of the script, because I was on the Fox lot a couple of weeks ago for the screening. They screened it for me and my team. And my wife was with me, who then I didn't know. And I said, look, that's the building we went into when we read the first X-Men script, sitting around a big table, because there were a lot of us.
Yeah.
And, of course, there were a lot of just fantastic people in that room. Rebecca Stamos and Anna Paquin, and James Marsden, Hugh, of course, who... No, there wasn't.
No,
Hugh
wasn't there
cast.
Yet. Yeah.
No, we were already filming in Toronto when Hugh joined the movie. It was just a great read-through, and I thought, my word, we have something very special here. In those days, I don't think anybody was thinking in terms of a franchise. And those were early days of comic book movies, too.
Yeah, it was really the first big one to break through. Maybe Blade before that, but you know, it was X-Men that sort of was the proof of concept for the whole modern era. God.
It can all be traced back to you.
I wish I could say that, you know, but no, I was just a small cog in the wheel.
We have a thing now and again on the Empire podcast where we call the IMD bunker, where there's trivia sections for people on the IMDb. Which are generally filled with nonsense, and we get the person to debunk it or say it's true. Now, there is something I read in the IMDb about you earlier on, which I thought was amazing. It said, Monty Python publicly announced if there was ever going to be a reunion tour, that you would be Graham Chapman's replacement. True or false?
False, as far as I am aware.
I am debunked right here, right now. But you are a Monty Python fan. Is this true?
It's not possible to be my generation and to be an actor and not to be a Monty Python fan. They were brilliant and great, and I'm getting great pleasure introducing my wife to them, who wasn't too familiar.
Awesome.
With the films or the TV shows or the whole caboodle?
The whole, everything.
The whole thing. Okay, interesting. Which is your favorite film? Grail or Life of Brian?
Oh, I think Life of Brian.
When I spoke to you at the end of last year about Logan, at that point I think you'd had something like 3 days off at a time all year. Because
four.
four
consecutive days.
Four consecutive days, good Lord. So is this year looking a little bit calmer, or are you similarly booked up so far?
Not at all, no. Last year was crazy.
Yeah.
4 months on a television series, 2 months in Louisiana on Logan, and 6 months on stage here in London. When our promotion for this movie is over, I am going to bury myself in the West Oxfordshire countryside.
Very, very wise. Sounds like a plan.
Well, we shall let you get on with that. Patrick Stewart, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you very much indeed.
What a nice man.
Oh, what a legend.
He really is.
What a night, man.
That's very good. Okay, just before we continue, a word about our sponsors, Three. With Three, you can use your phone abroad at no extra cost, whether you're on pay monthly advanced plans or pay as you go, no matter if you're using a tablet, a phone or a dongle. Feel at Home works automatically. You'll receive a text message telling you you're in a Feel at Home destination when you arrive, and then you use your phone as normal, worry free. Then they tell you when you go back to the UK just how much you've saved, which is quite a few cocktails on the beach, believe me. Or in my case, actually, quite a few souvenir Supernatural t-shirts. But, you know, same difference. Mm-hmm. Time now for some lovely movie news. And this week we had the kind of really exciting trailer that makes you panic a bit at how hyped you're getting and lie awake at night worrying that the film can't possibly live up to your hopes. Or is that just me? No. Right?
Yeah,
because let's start with number one, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. This is the second or third trailer?
I think it's
a teaser and then a second full trailer. And this time, Gamora gets a line. My hashtag of free Gamora has finally paid off. What do we think of this?
It looks great.
Come on, yeah, it looks great. It's Guardians. It's funny. It's colourful. It's witty. It's got a fantastic soundtrack. I really love the use of Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
You can't go wrong with a bit of the chain. Yeah, I mean, it's just looks bright and energetic, and I just love how every character is a different colour. you could get them all together and do a colour chart, but it looks really fun, and I'm intrigued by the bad guys in this one. They're kind of, somebody pointed out online that they look like evil Oscars.
Maybe like it's a meta commentary on the fact that superhero movies tend to get overlooked at Oscar time. That was my highfalutin voice.
Yes.
It's food for thought. And then you get a cheeky bit of Kurt Russell at the end, which is every trailer should have a little bit of cheeky
whether
Kurt
he's
Russell.
In the film or not.
Obviously he's playing Ego the Living Planet, who is Star-Lord's dad.
Mm-hmm.
So
How does that work then? He's a planet, but he's also Kurt Russell.
He can be planet sized, or he can be Kurt Russell sized.
Obviously.
So can you sort of land your spaceship on Kurt Russell? How does it work? Does he have like an orbiting moon?
Does he have a gravity well? What we're asking. Well, he obviously has a gravitas well.
That was solid.
I'm so sorry.
I don't know that they've all been quite cagey in terms of the ins and outs of Kurt Russell's planet-esque qualities in this film, but
because he looked pretty human like in that shot.
He looked like Kurt Russell.
I didn't notice any sort of like satellites
or craters.
I'm not familiar with the comic books as you might be.
No, I'm not either, to be honest. I'm not answering your question.
You're digging
deep, but I'm running the other way.
Come on, Nick.
It's one of the movie's many mysteries. We still don't know who Sylvester Stallone is going to be playing in the
true,
film.
Yeah.
Whether that's just going to be a little cameo or something more. But yeah, it looks really fun. It looks really fun.
It does. I'd like to play devil's advocate a little bit here. I'm concerned with this and the other trailer that they're overplaying the cuteness of Baby Groot.
You think this?
A little bit. I felt like some of the humour just felt a little bit childish. And part of the appeal of Guardians is that it's not childish, that it's quite grown-up humour, that it's quite sort of filthy and a bit irreverent, and it felt a bit cartoonish.
Well, but they sort of they trod the line last time, didn't they? Between being,
I mean, like it's fun.
Those lines, I mean, the really filthy lines, go completely over kids' heads. They could get away with quite a lot.
The Jackson Pollock line, yeah.
The Jackson Pollock, yeah. That is the dirtiest line in Marvel movie. Yeah. I mean, even including Deadpool, that's the dirtiest line. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, Baby Groot looks... you've got to give Baby Groot the benefit of the doubt.
In his little space suit?
He looks like a cross between a mandrake from Harry Potter and a gremlin. And he just... I mean, I think he's going to be fun.
He will be fun, I'm sure.
I know they're pitching him quite hard.
The cynical part of me thinks it's a merchandising opportunity. And, you know, they've got a whole load of Baby Groot plush toys waiting in some factory.
Oh, I'm sure they have that as well, but it doesn't have to necessarily be cynical. And I think from everything that James Gunn has said throughout his Marvel experience, he's very much my idea first and marketing second.
Yes.
You know, so you've got to hope it comes from a good
place. We have faith in Gunn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, whoa. All right, NRA dude. Jeez.
Hands off our gun.
The other big trailer of the week, of course, was Alien Covenant.
Mm.
So what did you guys think of this?
We got a bit of attention stroke flack for the last shot, or one of the last shots, which was the alien on the windscreen, which was CG.
Yeah.
Quite obviously CG. Mm. And I think people, you know, obviously there's a CG alien in Alien Resurrection and a lot of CG in Prometheus, so it's not a new thing, but I think a lot of people, you know, given it's the classic alien coming back, want to see the man in the suit stroke, that kind of vibe to it.
Which, I mean, spoiler, there 100% definitely is in this film.
Hmm.
100% definitely are mechanical and puppeted.
And you know, because you've been there, you've been on set.
And I was on set, so yes, this is 100%
definite.
You
were in a suit.
I have been... I would not fit in one of those. They do not have a lot of, you know, give. But they 100% definitely had... I mean, I went around the creature shop and it was astonishing. And they have built everything. And even the things that were going to be CG'd or partly CG'd, they built to be scanned, to be, you know... Mm. To be used that way. So, yeah, so I'm hoping that's very much a minority of shots, and B, it's possible it's an unfinished shot at this point. Yeah. So, you know, there might still be some tweaking to do.
But it's exciting. It's the return of the classic Alien.
Yeah.
Like classic Coke. Yeah. And I think, you know, Ridley Scott didn't want to do it for Prometheus was almost had that the original Alien in it, and then he changed it at the last minute. So I think people are really excited. I'm excited to see the Alien come back. And there's a new type, isn't there?
Yes, so we kind of glimpsed it, I think, in this trailer, didn't we? The sort of the neomorph.
Yeah.
Which is the...
smaller, but more energetic, more kind of vicious.
Yeah, than the original sort of baby chest burster.
Yeah. And it looks like nightmare fodder.
It really, really does, yeah. I mean, I'm very susceptible to the scariness of alien films, obviously, because I'm a big coward. But it does look properly scary. My only worry about the trailers for this film is they're giving you a lot of information about deaths.
Yes, the last trailer was a bit spoilery, and we had a lot of complaints on the Empire Facebook group, people saying, you know, okay, so we know that character's dead. And, I mean, you know, it's an alien film, so you can expect most... of the characters will die.
I just want Danny McBride to make it to the end, because he just looks like the most expendable character in cinema history. Yeah. And if Danny McBride makes it to the end alive, I'll be so happy.
But victory for
he won't.
He's like, world over.
He just won't.
I don't know. To play Johnny Devil's advocate Nugent here, I'm concerned it looks a little bit generic from the trailers we've seen. I'm just wondering what is new that they're bringing to the franchise.
I think there's going to be some interesting stuff here. I think it's going to be interesting to see how we progress from Prometheus towards a traditional alien. I think that's what this film is really designed to do. And I think there was actually a thread on Twitter yesterday that Robbie Cullen retweeted. If you're not spoiler averse...
I did see that.
I think that's about 90% spot on.
Yeah.
So
about the Greek myths.
Greek myths and so on. So I think there's some really interesting sort of thematic stuff coming in.
Yes.
But I hope it will also be a really scary film, which is important as well. And I'm fascinated to see what Michael Fassbender and Michael Fassbender do as David and Walter.
Whether they do a sort of double act song and dance routine at one point.
I mean, that's what I'm hoping for. You remember the La La Land poster, sort of that, but against the background of this planet. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a nice little gladiator-esque moment in the trailer with some wheat or some long grass. I can't remember exactly what it is.
Yeah, Ridley loves his wheat.
It's a nice, lovely shot. But yeah, I get where you're coming from, John. It's you know, it's another movie where a crew of people land and this alien comes along. And I hope it doesn't just end up with them getting bumped off one by one until Catherine Waterston is in her underwear and running around. Like, I just hope that they have something.
I hope she doesn't have to avoid a ship slowly crashing down to Earth, and she
like
know,
a just, donut, yeah, like a rolling ship,
yeah, and she doesn't run sideways.
Charlize Theron syndrome,
yeah.
I haven't been able to watch that bit of Prometheus and not laugh since Dan pointed out that he once drove down a road and there was a squirrel running in front of the car and it just wouldn't go sideways. That's kind of ruined Prometheus.
Yeah, Charlize Theron has the wit of a squirrel.
In that film. In real life, she knows how to go sideways. She does it often, I'm sure.
She's not like Zoolander. She can turn left.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got a couple of bits of TV news about the casting of Marvel's Inhumans. Anson Mount. Now, if James were here, which obviously he isn't, he would say that Anson Mount was extremely good in Hell on Wheels. Of course, most viewers will probably remember him from the Britney Spears Odyssey Crossroads.
Oh, well,
I mean, I think that's really what stands out. But he will be playing Black Bolt, whose full name is, of course, Blackagar Boltagon. I'm not kidding. I'm really not. Who is king of the Inhumans.
Okay.
And his voice is so powerful that if he like speaks above a whisper, he can basically like blow planets apart. Like, he's super, super loud.
Like, so, Brian Blessed, basically.
Like Brian, very much like that, except usually without the beard. Yeah. So so basically, Black Bolt doesn't really speak because he can't, like, he's too powerful. So luckily, he's married to a lady who is a mind reader.
So he doesn't need to hold cards up like Andrew Lincoln in Love Actually.
Exactly, yes.
That would be the alternative.
Yes.
Which would take a long time to get
super
through.
Super long time and be really quite offensive given that that's your best friend's wife and she's just gotten married yet.
Uh-oh.
But Surinder Swan has been cast as Medusa, his wife, who has magic hair.
Wow. And when is this programme coming?
This programme is coming. I'm not sure. Hang on. What is it? So the premiere will be in IMAX cinemas in September.
Okay.
And then it goes to TV.
Okay.
So that's unusual. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. This was originally going to be a movie that was on the Marvel release schedule as a movie, and they've kind of quietly shunted it off to one side. TV-ified it, yeah. So that's happening. Okay. There is also Pirates of the Caribbean news, isn't
there? Yeah, there's a new poster for Pirates of the Caribbean. I'm still trying to get my head around the title for this one because it's different in America to how it is here.
Yes.
So it's Dead Men Tell No Tales here.
Right.
And Salazar's Revenge in America, unless it's the other way around.
I think it's the other way around.
It's the other way around.
I think it's Salazar's Revenge here.
Right.
Because
Salazar is better known in Europe.
Yeah, I don't know.
He's huge here.
he'll play big.
So Salazar is obviously the sort of the baddie of the piece, and he is played
Javier
by
Bardem.
Javier Bardem.
Yes.
And judging by the poster, bits of him, his face are going to sort of come off. He looks like he's sort of decomposing on the poster.
So not in a sort of Nick Cage, John Travolta way, but in
No, just looks like parts of his face are flying off. I'm not sure if that's representative.
More of a scurvy sort of way, maybe.
It just goes flaky. To show that exfoliation is super important. Like moisturise.
Especially on the sea.
And exfoliate. Especially
when you're
undead
pirate.
Come on,
so
guys.
He is Jack Sparrow's old nemesis. And the main thing about this poster, though, there's a lot of human characters on it. The most exciting thing is there are two sharks and they are zombie sharks.
What?
And this is exciting, and I hope this isn't just like I hope this is a major part of the plot and it's not just a sort of throwaway shot or two. I hope that Salazar has a legion of zombie sharks that he unleashes.
Legion of zombie sharks.
Because how do you one-up a kraken? A zombie hammerhead shark.
I mean, I've often wondered that, yeah.
And has it been bitten by another?
Do you think there's shark?
Is it the swimming dead? anyway, that's the main thing about that poster.
And Barbossa is still in it somehow.
Yes.
Still there.
There's rumours that Jack Davenport might be coming back, even though he died in one of the earlier films.
Didn't he? That's weird. Wow.
Yeah.
And we have on the poster as well, we also have Brenton Thwaite as Henry.
Yep.
And Kaya Scodelario as Karina, is that right? Smith or Smythe?
Uh huh.
Who are obviously the new young lovers of this particular installment.
Yeah.
Zombie sharks.
Skeptical, but just excited about the aquatic creature element.
Let's just hope Johnny Depp has a license for those sharks. Otherwise, there could be some some visa issues.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Brenton Thwaites is Australian as well, so he could dob him in. You know?
Yeah.
a little bit of final news this week, which just struck me as unusual. Tom McCarthy, of course, won the Best Picture last year for Spotlight. And he's decided to follow that up by writing, or rewriting rather, the script for Disney's Christopher Robin movie.
That's amazing.
So this is a kind of latter day. It tells the tale of a middle-aged Christopher Robin. He's all grown up and he's got a wife and kids.
Yeah.
But he's too interested in his work.
Uh-huh.
And not spending enough time on his family, and it's all about poo.
it's so important to potty train your kids.
It's really all about poo coming back and teaching him poo-based lessons.
Poo bear, okay.
Poo the bear. Poo
Tom
bear.
McCarthy really fascinates me. He's had such a strange and varied career. He did like The Station Agent, which was incredible. He was, I think, a writer on Up, Pixar's Up.
He was, yeah.
He was a producer on Game of Thrones. He appeared in The Wire, in the last season of The Wire.
Yeah, he was great in that.
And he also directed the terrible Adam Sandler comedy The Cobbler.
Yeah, straight before winning Best Picture for Spotlight.
In the same year as winning Best Picture. So, I mean, who is this guy? And now he's doing a Disney film.
And how does he make this not Hook? That's the question.
Yeah.
I mean, because it sounds exactly like Hook.
And
right?
The other thing about this is it's live action. It's a live action Pooh Bear film. So we're going to get live action. I mean, obviously not live action, but we're going to get CG Heffalump, CG Tigger. Mm. Who's going to be playing Tigger? I mean, I'm kind of excited because this sounds insane.
Maybe like, they're getting real tigers.
It's either going to be, you know, like the Jungle Book, and it's going to be. It's not going to be like. I just don't know
how you do it. Maybe more like Paddington. Maybe Paddington is the model here.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but I guess so more good. CG characters. I'm intrigued, but...
Hmm. Winnie the Pooh...
Could we get a Calvin the Hobbes movie at some point? I don't know.
Yes. But we won't, no, because Bill Waterston probably doesn't want one. Okay. But Mark Forster is still down to direct this one, so McCarthy's just rewriting the script. He's not currently, anyway, in the director's chair. So... I don't know. It could be. I mean, it could be great because we loved Paddington, you know, and we love Hook, right? Everybody loves Hook. So,
yeah. I guess Paddington was more of a traditional take on the stories, whereas this sounds quite
true. Yeah,
having a middle-aged Christopher Robin.
Yeah,
I mean, is Pooh going to be middle-aged as well?
Yeah. What is the bear's lifespan? do they have
it'd be
a
depressing if they're just all really old?
Yeah,
I don't think they will be though.
Old
will
people's
they?
Home of, eels, of just colourful animals.
Eels been put down.
I don't know. It's an odd one. I did love the 2011 Winnie the Pooh film, which I thought was really clever because it's for kids. It's just like a completely gentle, lovely little story. Mm. But there's so much kind of weird breaking the fourth wall for older viewers. It's really clever, actually, if you've I don't know if you've seen it, but so maybe they'll do something really clever with this, you know, because that one was great. And basically in the 2011 film they had things like Winnie the Pooh's friends reaching out of the drawings onto the page and using the letters to do things, you know, which was super charming. So I'm hoping that this will be just as lovely.
And there's an A.A. Milne movie in the works as well.
Yes, is that the one with Donald Gleeson?
Donald Gleeson and Margot Robbie, I think.
That's right, yeah. And so Pooh is back in a major way.
Has it ever left?
Well, I wouldn't like to say.
Oh, good Lord.
I wouldn't like to say.
Just on topic for this week, finally, I think, James Mangold has been teasing a possible black and white version of Logan. Now, our own Ollie Gibbs was one of the many to say, wouldn't this be great, when he saw the film, in the sort of Mad Max black and chrome sort of a way. Mm. And it seems that Mangold and potentially Fox agree and are working on a black and white version of the film. If you have seen the film already, you'll know that's a good thing. If you haven't, go see it, and then you'll probably... be up for it as well.
Yeah, I don't get it. I haven't seen the black and chrome Fury Road version, but I just don't quite get it. Like, these are films that are really colourful, and that's how they were designed and shot. And I mean, I don't get it. Logan is a kind of beautiful Western.
It is beautiful as
desert
it sounds,
sort of landscapes.
Yeah.
Why would that be improved by being black and white? Anyway.
Hey, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah.
And I think we have to finish this week's news section on the worst news of the week, and certainly the saddest news of the week, which was the sad death of Bill Paxton at only 61 years of age. A man who, it's fair to say, appears in most of Empire's favourite films, it feels like.
Yes.
And was one of the... I mean, he kind of had a leading man's looks, but a character actor's career. He just stood out in basically everything he did. He's incredible in Near Dark. He, of course, is an essential part of the success of Aliens. He was killed by a Terminator as well. He was killed by a Predator as well. Mm-hmm. So he made all his monster movies great. He was also an incredibly talented director. Frailty is one of the great actor-turned-director debuts, and it's a real shame he didn't get to make more films because I think they would have been really something to see. But... yeah, what a shock and what a loss. And the tributes have absolutely flooded in from all corners of Hollywood. Basically, everyone who has worked with him, met him, known him, has said that he was one of the genuinely nicest men in town, which is obviously more important than any number of great films. But, I mean, this is a film podcast. We're going to talk about the great films.
He was such a reliable everyman, wasn't he? Like in so many of his films, he pops up, and you know he was not often the leading role, but he made such an impact in such a small amount of time for many films. I mean, you know, the obvious ones are things like Aliens, but you look at stuff like, you know, Apollo 13.
God, he's so good in that.
He's so good in Apollo 13. I mean, even his work in Titanic. You know, I mean, he's obviously always collaborating with James Cameron, and the bookends in Titanic.
Yeah,
you know, he makes such an impression on a 3-hour running time.
He was so good natured, and I think that came across in so many of his roles. Just that humour that he was just a very, very funny man.
But he could also be a complete douche brilliantly. I mean, True Lies or Terminator.
Yeah. Weird Science. I mean, he and then he had another side to him, which if you've seen his directorial debut. He made two films as director. The first one's Frailty.
Frailty, incredible.
Which
film.
Is one of the darkest films I've ever seen. I mean, it's a fantastic film. I've never forgotten it. I don't think I'll ever watch it again. But, yeah. I mean, it's a very powerful kind of piece of work. But, I mean, he was just a great raconteur as well. If you ever had the opportunity to talk to him, I interviewed him about 5 years ago for an Aliens special that we did. And just the stories, just brilliant. He told a great story about James Cameron and a tea lady at Pinewood. But just a really funny, warm, genuine guy.
Yeah.
There's a great interview with him from a few years ago on 18 Cool News that just got published. It was never published before. And it's a really long, just sort of freewheeling interview where he just talks about his sort of early career, but also just like the films he likes. Yeah. You know, he was a big fan of like Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg's movies. He thought Hot Fuzz was really good. And, you know, you can tell from this interview, he waxes lyrical and he really knows his stuff. And he's a genuine film fan.
Genuine cinephile, yeah. I've read those kind of things. He knew like the whole of cinema. While he's best known for these big blockbusters, that he knew everything. Really, he said, watched everything.
He said Harold and Maude was the film that made him want to become an actor, which I don't think anyone would have predicted or drawn a line between him and that film. But yeah, just a fascinating guy. And,
absolutely.
I mean, that 61 is way too young.
I mean, we're not exaggerating when we say he is the most quoted man, I think, in the Empire office.
Oh, absolutely.
And I don't think it's that close, actually, in terms of his film lines and his memorable performances. So Bill Paxton will be much missed. Okay, well, that's a really sad note, I'm afraid. It's on to this week's film, so hopefully there'll be some better news there. Now, just before we start, we covered Logan last week because it came out on Wednesday. So just to recap, if you didn't listen to last week's pod, we really, really like it.
Yes.
A lot.
Yes, we do.
So that got 4 stars, and it was a very high 4 stars. Personally, I'd go 5, but that's just me. But it's a really, really, really good film. And even if you've been burned by the 2 previous Wolverines, do not fear this one.
It's the best X-Men movie ever made.
All right. I'm not going to even argue with you.
I know. I prefer X-Men 2, but this is the second best.
All right, fair enough. I'm also not going to argue with that. They're both kind of up there for me. That's fine. Okay, so what is out this week, otherwise, competing with Logan? If you've seen Logan already on Wednesday, John, tell me about Certain Women.
Yeah, so this is Certain Women. This is the latest film from Kelly Reichardt. If you're not familiar with her, she's sort of operated on the sort of fringes of Hollywood, I guess. She's a sort of indie filmmaker, but she's done some amazing work. She did Wendy and Lucy, did a Western called Meek's Cutoff, and did Night Moves a few years ago, which was very, very good. And this is her latest film, which is in a similar sort of vein to her previous work. It's it is a very much an indie movie. It's a quiet movie. It's a thoughtful movie. It's basically a story about 3 women or 4 women perhaps. It's told in 3 parts, and their lives sort of intersect in a very small town called Livingston in Montana in American Midwest. Basically all of Kelly Reichardt's films are set in the Midwest. She's very fascinated by this, you know, very quiet, remote part of the country. So we start off with Laura Dern, the amazing Laura Dern, who plays a sort of small town lawyer having to deal with basically terrible men. So she's having to deal with a client played by Jared Harris, who is impossible to deal with. He ultimately becomes a little bit violent, and you know, her section is all about the sort of stresses of dealing with problematic clients. And then we move on to Michelle Williams, who is a sort of wife and mother trying to live a sort of more nomadic lifestyle. And basically her entire section is about negotiations over a pile of rocks, which is about, this is the sort of the high level excitement drama that we get from this sort of film. And then finally we have a section with Kristen Stewart and a newcomer, Lily Gladstone, who plays a horse rancher. And that for me was the most successful of the 3 sections, I suppose. It's sort of a tale of unrequited love. And the whole film is you know, very sort of quiet and thoughtful. Very little happens. I mean, it's...
Our Terry White suggested that this was basically the girl version of Patterson in terms of things happening. Is that fair?
Oh, very much so. Like they really share a sort of sensibility and a sort of dramatic outlook, I suppose. Mm-hmm. They're neither of them... are interested in, you know, car chases or excitement or gun shoots. Although this this movie does have a little bit of tenseness in the early act when Jared Harris has a gun, but it all ends relatively quietly. You know, the Kelly Reichardt's films are a lot about just sort of, you're picking up these transient moments, you're picking up like the sort of these little windows into people's lives, and there's all sorts of things that are going on under the surface that you sort of, she's inviting the audience to look at. So there's a lot of unsaid things, and especially Michelle Williams' section, and Michelle Williams is fantastic, as she always is. There's an incredible sort of passive aggression to her family. There's clearly something bubbling in this marriage that is not going well, but it's never really explained, it's never really touched upon in a you know, specific or explicit way. So it's more about just getting these tiny little windows into people's lives, and it feels incredibly authentic. Like her, the acting is so understated and so sort of naturalistic. It's just an incredibly genuine portrayal of very ordinary women living in a sort of rural existence.
All right, so. Four stars then?
So four stars. It's a really, it's not a big film, it's not a blowy film, but it's a beautiful film. And I highly recommend it.
And remember, this is a different film from 20th Century Women.
Yes.
This is Certain Women. Two films out with women in at the same time, the world could end. Okay, next up we have Trespass Against Us, which is a little bit of an Assassin's Creed reunion, because it sees Brendan Gleeson once again join Michael Fassbender. So Colby, who's Gleeson's character, is the head of a sort of a traveller clan, if you will. Fassbender plays his son Chad, who wants a better life for his own children. He's trying to make sure that they stay in school, that they learn, and they, you know, have other options available to them. But he keeps getting kind of pulled back into his father's ways. And this is, to be clear, this is not true of all traveller families, but this particular family has some rather dodgy dealings and dodgy goings on in their lives. And basically, Colby is extremely reluctant to let Chad kind of break free of that model and move himself away from the family in any way. So it's a kind of a struggle for independence on one hand and for family cohesion on the other hand. And that's basically the central dilemma, I guess, of the film. So, you know, Fassbender plays a guy who's basically kind of illiterate. He's never known anything but this life, but he's still desperate to give his kids something else and give them another option in life. They are also, it should be made clear, you know, kind of put upon by the outside world. They're very isolated. They're very, viewed with a lot of suspicion by the people that they meet outside, which kind of contributes to that kind of clannish atmosphere. And so it's basically this kind of, I guess, pressure cooker relationship between the two men at the heart of this wider family, you know, with sort of cousins, hangers-on, but isolated from the outside world and what they can do about it. So I don't know. I mean, I saw this a few months ago. It hasn't massively stayed with me. I do think there are flaws which Dan picks up in his review about the, you know, the female characters can maybe be a little bit stronger, I think, here. But I have to say that the acting between the central pair is astonishing, and I think that's why Dan has given it the very good review that he has. 4-star film from him. I agree with him, actually. It has shades of Shane Meadows' early work. So there's that kind of a feel to it, kind of very gritty British filmmaking kind of a feel. And great, great work, obviously, by Gleeson and Fassbender together. So yeah, 4 stars for Trespass Against Us. This is a 4-star week so far.
So far. Will it stay that way for the third and final review?
Well, let's see if it can. Nick, what can you tell us about Viceroy's House?
So Viceroy's House, first of all, a Viceroy, in case you don't know, because I didn't, is a representative of the king or queen in a foreign country. So in this case, the Viceroy is Lord Mountbatten, played by Hugh Bonneville, taking a break from being Lord Grantham in Downton Abbey. So basically, this is a film by Gurinder Chadha, who, it was actually inspired by her appearing on the BBC TV show Who Do You Think You Are? And she decided to, she learned more about the kind of the end of the British rule in India at the end of the 1940s, and decided to make a film about it. And so this film sees Hugh Bonneville's character, and Gillian Anderson plays his wife, Lady Edwina, and they're in Delhi. And the British are basically withdrawing from India, and violence is sort of, you know, happening all over the country. And it's a good film without being a great film. It's a fascinating period of history, but the human characters are a little bit one note for the most part, and it's not as subtle or as kind of interesting as gripping as you'd hope it would be. And there's a slightly generic romance in the servants' quarter between a Hindu boy and a Muslim girl. The performance is very good on the whole. Gillian Anderson especially is really, really good. But it's a little bit thin.
All right.
So we've given that 3 stars.
Okay, but still a recommendation. 3 stars is, of course, a recommendation. And then 3 4-star films also to catch up on this week. So get going to the cinema.
It's also worth pointing out Moonlight is being re-released this
and
Friday.
Expanded
release across the UK in cinemas. And that is a 5-star film and also an Oscar Best Picture winner. So go see that.
Yeah, if you haven't seen that, now is the time.
Mm. Did you hear about the Rio Cinema here in London?
Oh, yeah.
Showed there was a screening of Moonlight and they put on the first 2 minutes of La La Land and then turned it off and put Moonlight on.
That is genius.
That's great trolling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you worked on La La Land and you happened to go along to that screening, you probably would have just wept. But no, that is pretty funny.
That's it for this week's Empire Podcast, brought to you by Three. Now, on Monday, join us again. We're going to be putting up our Logan spoiler special with an extensive interview with James Mangold, which, believe me, is awesome. He was absolutely fascinating in that. And then the following week, I think we're going to have a
Skull Island
spoiler special. So watch out for that one as well. We've got 2 spoiler specials coming up. The regular podcast, however, will be back next week at the normal time for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by Tom Hiddleston.
Oh my God!
Love him!
Hiddlepod.
The Hiddlepod, yes. Until then, it's goodbye from John.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Nick.
Goodbye. I'm off to finish reading my 90,000 words about Castiel, the shirtless vampire, or whatever he is.
Angel. He's an angel.
Sorry. Former vampire.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to find some new accountants for the Empire podcast so I don't open the wrong envelope next time. Goodbye.